our friends with Fantasy Benefits.
Mike, how hard are you right now?
Oh, man, I've been hard since you said, hi, welcome to Friends with Fantasy Benefits podcast.
Isn't he, like, MVP?
He's listed at 6'5 and 280, so the first thing I want to do is thank him for making me feel svelte, which is not an easy thing to do.
We are Friends with Fantasy Benefits.
Because Oakland is the flipper of all flippers. It's the incentive-laden podcast, for God's sakes.
We are Friends with Fantasy Benefits.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a Friends with Fantasy Benefits concept podcast. I am Chuck Anderson. I can be reached at Just Chucking It on Twitter. Things are crazy right now. The TGFBI drafts are going bonkers. We're trying to catch up. I'm in the slowest drafting league. Andrew Dewhurst, who joins us today, apparently has the championship team. I don't even know why we're playing this thing out. Andrew, how are you today, my friend?
I'm doing all right. Happy to have my great fantasy baseball invitational draft completed. I guess it's been done for me for like 5 or 6 days now. So just think I'm almost done all of my drafts now. So I'm feeling like a little bit lost what I'm supposed to do with my extra time if I'm not building and categorizing draft rankings.
Well, I have two local leagues, which were my base leagues. My launching point into fantasy baseball was local leagues. And I have two of those drafts left. And I'm in the midst of three slow drafts yet, including what I think is going to be the last draft done in TGFBI. We are lagging behind by a round or two the other slowest drafts. So that is happening. But to set the stage for the concept of the day, I want to mention that something has really struck me in recent weeks, that these players who have had to wait out an extra long and unusually sluggish market for free agents are amongst a number of players that have really interesting motivations going into this season. And I've sort of dubbed this in my head as the Incentive Plan podcast, because there's a number of pundits out there who like to say that a player's level of motivation or a player's level of incentive doesn't really matter much. These are professional athletes, and they go out and they try to perform their best at all times. And I am going to try and debunk that or play devil's advocate against it. And a lot of these concepts, you know, are ones where it's kind of like a debate club sort of thing, where you're really trying to get behind a motive or an idea for what's going on. And my issue here is I don't know how to believe in the concept of motivation for this level of athlete. But I'm going to take the side of the fact that I think special situations will garner special effort, special attention to detail, and maybe an especially high performance. Do you believe, Andrew, first of all, we didn't get your Twitter handle. So give us your Twitter handle and then tell us if you think that players in certain situations will perform better than normal.
You can find me on Twitter at Andrew K. Dewhurst. I think there's situations where, I think it's a little bit different for each and every player. And motivation, you know, has a lot to do with things like background, and it's what drives each player. And I think it'll be interesting when we go through and talk about these players, because we don't know much, at least personally, I don't know much about a lot of these different players' backgrounds to understand if they're really intrinsic or extrinsically motivated, but be happy to speculate on each and every one.
Yeah, I tried to come up with a fairly eclectic list of players that have extra reasons to want this to be a career year for them. And it is definitely a tricky thing. I recall what Justin Mason had said last week, that that perhaps there is something to this concept, but how predictive can we be upon these players due to the fact that we all hear that, you know, contract years or, you know, being snubbed or a player coming back to his home city. We always hear that these things are overblown and that they're not actually much of a motivational factor for players. Yet, I find it hard to believe that that's actually the case. Certain instances in recent years, I recall an interview where Carlos Gomez denied that he ever played for the Houston Astros. And it just seems like there is a level of comfort that matters to certain players. And there's also, obviously, some need to really add earning potential that happens to players. And a combination of these different motives and incentives are sort of something that we're going to go over as we go over our player list today. And the first player that I want to touch on is arguably one of the most controversial players. You would think that his career has been a massive disappointment, yet it's hard to believe that 25-year-old Bryce Harper has achieved so much at this young of an age, and now he's going into an offseason. Well, he's going into a season that's going to lead into an offseason where he could sign the biggest contract we've ever seen a baseball player sign. And trying to figure out if he's especially motivated this year to have an incredible season. I'm really curious as to what Andrew thinks about this.
Well, so part of the hang-up I'm going to have on some of these are going to be that I always would like to imagine that if you're a baseball player or you're a professional athlete, that you should always, especially moving into your first big contract, you should be motivated each and every time you step on the field. Bryce Harper, I think, in a lot of ways, is the epitome of an effort player. And that's what fans love about Bryce Harper is, yeah, he does get hurt. But he's a guy who you can see giving 100% all of the time. So I don't think I don't think a guy like Bryce Harper needs motivation. You know, to be fair, like if he gets, you know, $100, $200, $300, or $4 million, it's not ultimately changing his life any differently when you're looking at that scale. So, you know, to be fair about it, I think he's a guy who shows up and tries his hardest every day. So I would expect that to continue, whether it be this year, next year, or the year after, which I think offers some safety for Bryce Harper. I don't think he's going to go to a bad situation. I mean, Washington's a great situation. If he goes, and unless he's ultimately just looking to get as much money as he possibly can next year, and he doesn't care what team wants to give it to him, I just don't see any reason to really be down on Bryce Harper in any way that way.
Well, my Bryce Harper story is kind of is interesting and it meanders. I certainly was ultra high on him coming into his major league career, which disappointment is a relative term. I mean, some of the things that this guy has done already are unthinkable for a player of his age. Only coming into the league with Mike Trout could make this seem like he's done any level of underperformance. Now, the middle of last year, in my Of Note column, I announced that I was probably not going to own Bryce Harper for any of the next 5 seasons, which I'm learning that was probably a pretty bad idea to make a bold statement like that. And let me explain why. I was under the assumption that Bryce Harper was always going to go in the top 4 to 6 picks at the worst, and that I had seen enough fluctuation in his stat lines and enough issues with nagging injuries that I didn't think that I could pull the trigger on him there. So now it's the beginning of this season, and I own him in 2 drafts already. One I got him in the ninth pick, and once I got him at the 12th pick. And I keep thinking to myself, well, you know, I guess that makes me a liar in from my written word. But I never thought he was going to last to that point in drafts. And I always thought if I was comparing him to the most elite Cadillacs, that how would I draft him? Well, this year, the story of how I drafted him is the first time I drafted him ninth, it pretty much, if I wasn't going to take a pitcher, I was going to take either him or Giancarlo Stanton. And I'm asking myself, what is the difference between Stanton and Harper? Stanton has this incredible amount of talent. Stuff has always gone wrong in almost every year, except for last year. And Harper is an incredible talent. And he had one year where everything went together, everything came together. And the other years, he wasn't the player that we hoped he would be. But when you really look at the back of his baseball card, has he really been a bad player in any of the years? Now, I put together some stats for you. His BABIP, his batting average on balls in play since 2014, 352, 369, 264. His bad year when he hit 243, he had a 264 BABIP, and then last year it was 356. So you tell me what the outlier is when his 264 BABIP is almost 100 points lower than any other season. And we all know that the ball just pops off of his bat. So is Bryce Harper, just look at him, is he a good BABIP guy or a bad BABIP guy? Okay. Now, we're talking about a player who is dropping in drafts. Like, I hear nothing but negativity about him as a near the beginning of the first round player. Everyone says, you know, he's got to be a late first rounder. Okay. His lowest projections for this coming season, 32 home runs, 93 runs, 94 RBIs, and a 323 batting average. That's his lowest projection. If you take the four projection systems off of FanGraphs and run the lowest possible stat line that you can across the line, that's what you get. Now, let me place this in contrast. These are the highest projections for what he could do. 38 home runs, 105 runs scored, 127 RBIs, and a 341 batting average. Those are projected numbers that projection systems have come up for what he could do this year. And I'm posing this on the incentive end, and I know I'm going off on a rant, Andrew, and I will let you cut in here in a second. But I'm suggesting that when a player is this great, when you're a great player, a little extra motivation can really, really matter. And I think the incentive for Bryce Harper this year could very well be that we have a sluggish free agent class this year, and he's thinking to himself that he wants to be the highest paid player. He wants to sign the highest contract in Major League Baseball history, and that might motivate him to be closer to the highest projections than he is to the lowest projections. So now you can debunk my theory.
Sure. It actually raised an interesting point. I'd never thought of putting Stanton and Harper together, but which one's health do you think is, like, if I'm buying into player health, I think I'm actually willing to buy into Stanton more than I'm willing to buy into Harper. And the reason for that is Stanton has had possibly the worst luck imaginable, right? He's on his way to an MVP season and he gets hit in the jaw from Mike Fiers of all people, breaks his jaw, kills the rest of the year, doesn't win MVP like 2 or 3 years ago, gets hit in the hand, he breaks his hand. Stuff with Harper has been more ailing type stuff. It's which I think is more reason to be concerned. And when I look at these, it's great to look at projections, and I was under the impression that for the most part, projections were meant to be like give you the bottom line. But we see if any set of these four projections pan out between Depth Chart, Steinmer, Fans, and Zips, isn't he like MVP? Like probably, or at least in the top five of that ballot. I mean, they're projecting him to do things he's never done before, like. Believe it or not, Bryce Harper has never had a 100 RBI season. Just think about that for a minute. Even when he won, hit 42 home runs and scored 118 runs. I don't know. Like, I struggle with health, and in the biggest reason I would not be taking Bryce Harper in the first round is that we all know that about somewhere between 50 and 60% of first rounders don't return you first round value. And I think a big reason for that happening is health. And Harper's health is anything but a sure thing. And if he's hoping to, if this offseason is telling us anything, if you're hoping to cash in, you might want to think about it for a little bit longer, because it looks like owners are finally actually counting their money and realizing that players aren't necessarily worth this. I mean, you look at Mike Moustakas getting, what, $6.5 million, $8.5 million maybe, after coming off a 42 home run season, has a player that walks more than he strikes out. You know, guys just aren't making the money they're expecting. Agents like Scott Boras are coming back around to find that, you know, they've got four or five free agents still sitting around on the open market with no one looking to sign them for the money that they thought they were going to get. I think, you know, money in this case is starting to get a little bit bullish for these guys, and it'll be interesting to see what the ultimate outcome of some of this is.
Well, I agree that it's going to be hard to project exactly what's going to happen going forward between, you know, a collective bargaining agreement that could go haywire. We could end up sitting through a strike again, which, you know, I'm old enough to remember the last one pretty well, pretty vividly. I do think that Harper is in a different class, that I think because of his age, and if he does manage to play at least, say, 140-plus games this year, I think he stands a pretty good chance to have somebody break the bank for him. And like I said, I think it becomes a matter of pride for guys with this amount of talent. You know, when we think about motivation, this is what happens to me. You have groups of people, they take the whole group of major league players. Like the rest of the players we're going to talk about today, they group in with Bryce Harper and they say, well, a contract year doesn't matter to players like this. Some of them react well, some of them react poorly. Okay, Bryce Harper is not a major league player. He's not in that set. He's part of the set, but he's in a completely different subset. Okay? Mike Trout and Bryce Harper are the most elite talents that Major League Baseball has. And that is a huge statement, because every one of these guys is incredibly talented, obviously. But there's a different level. When we think about LeBron James in the NBA, when we think about Aaron Rodgers and Tom Brady in the NFL, when these guys are especially motivated, we think in our head that matters, because they can take it to levels that other athletes in their sport cannot. And that's the class that I'm putting Bryce Harper in. And you know, health is a question, but once you get to pick 9, who is health really not a question for? Is one of my things. Like you get this balance going back and forth now. I mean, you know, you take any of the pitchers there and you're like, well, you know, Corey Kluber's got quite a bit of mileage going already. Chris Sale was an injury risk before he was turned into a starting pitcher. I mean, I understand the questions about his health. I just think that there's two things. I don't personally play in, you know, $10,000 leagues or something where I have to be so worried about protecting risk that I can't take a chance on ultimate upside. Okay? And while, you know, I can see the alternative theory of being more conservative on the pick, I just think that once you get down to where there's health questions regardless, or there's some performance question, I think I can take a chance on incredible upside. And maybe I'm overvaluing the upside. Because last year at this time, I was telling people, I was saying, look, something always happens to Bryce Harper, and Bryce Harper is just not the guy that we thought he was going to be because of his one incredible season. But now I'm getting to the point where, you know, if he plays 125 or 130 games at the elite levels that these projection systems are taking all of their analytics and saying that this is the guy that this is, then if once he gets to 120 or 125 games, then I think you have a hard time blaming the season if it doesn't go well on Bryce Harper. And if you get 145 or 150 games at his best, I think he can throw your team on your back and carry it. On his back and carry it. And so that's the game that I'm playing in my head. And that's how I ended up with him in two leagues when I never thought I was going to. I didn't think it was going to happen. So he's a very interesting guy, and I think he's one of the most interesting incentive guys out there. And, he's going to be in stark contrast to the rest of the guys we're going to cover here that we'll actually have to cover quite a bit quicker than we did Bryce. All right, let's talk about an ex-Brewer, Jonathan Lucroy, 31 years old, now an Oakland Athletic, which we could go on and on about whatever the Oakland A's are this year because I hear varying theories all over the place. Okay, last year, 10.6% K rate and a 9.6% walk rate. Those are good numbers. In this day and age, those are really good plate discipline numbers. Okay, a 286 BABIP was, especially low for him in recent years. The eye-popping numbers are the 6 home runs, including a stint in Colorado. The 6 home runs, 45 runs scored, and 40 RBIs for a guy who's generally been fairly productive. Now, even with the lower BABIP, you're still looking at a guy who hit 260. How bad is that for a catcher? Where exactly should he go? Now he's got this, this one-year deal in Oakland, which is not where he thought he wanted to end up, for sure. He said he wanted to play on a contender. So what do we make of Jonathan Lucroy as a bounce-back candidate, Andrew?
I bought into Jonathan Lucroy somewhere in one of my drafts this year, just because the price was so low. I felt like the opportunity for it to return value was almost undeniable. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. I mean, he still hit 265 last year, which isn't that bad when you consider the catcher landscape. I just wonder if he's going to get past being another guy at this moment in time. I mean, he's only a year removed from a 24 home run, 81 RBI year where he hit 292. So, I mean, I think he still knows how to hit. It's just going to be a matter of, the home runs aren't going to be sky high. I don't think you're going to see 24 again. But I think somewhere in the mid teens to early 20s maybe is possible, and a lot of it's going to come down to the other numbers will have a lot to do with where he hits in the order and how much anyone actually gets on base, because I mean if he's got gap power he'll be do just fine because he's going to hit lots of doubles in Oakland, and he's also going to get to hit against some poor pitching. I mean the Rangers starting rotation is abysmal, and the Angels might not be much better, especially if they deal with another string of injuries to their starters. So Lucroy is going for almost nothing. I don't think him having a landing spot is going to skyrocket his value by any means. So I mean, for the price you're going to pay to get in on Lucroy, I think he's worth paying. It's worth paying if you're going to be somebody who waits till the end of the draft to grab a catcher.
Yeah, I certainly see those points. I think some of this is team context. Just as we look at motivation going forward, we can look at it going backwards, and we can say, maybe he was pressing last year trying to land a big contract. And also, while we think of Oakland as a bad landing spot for Lucroy offensively, because we think it probably cuts down on his home run total, there's two things about Oakland right now. The first thing about Oakland for a catcher is that maybe the rest of the team is good. Like that, there seems to be this theory that this all or nothing Oakland Athletics lineup, has a lot of upside with Semien and Olson, and Chris Davis has been steady power. Maybe this is a good team, relatively good for an Oakland Athletics team. So maybe that actually can sort of help his peripheral numbers more than we first think. The other thing, though, for a catcher who's known to be a very good receiver, very good pitch framer, and a good clubhouse guy and a good guy for building a pitching staff, is that I think if that pitching staff performs well, he's going to get a lot of the credit for that. And that could actually really help where he lands the following year. And we're not even talking about the fact that Oakland could flip him, which is originally when I saw this contract, I'm like, oh, Oakland's trying to flip him because Oakland is the flipper of all flippers. So, I mean, it's unlikely to me that I don't believe in the Oakland lineup like a lot of people do. So I 100% believe that he's going to do a good job and he's going to get flipped at the deadline. And where he gets flipped at the deadline could mean a lot to where his final numbers are. Maybe he gets a power boost at the end of the season. But anyway, I thought Jonathan Lucroy was a very interesting guy to talk about, especially right now. This sort of turned into a news show accidentally because the next player that we're going to talk about is Lance Lynn, who's listed at 6'5 and 280. So the first thing I want to do is thank him for making me feel svelte, which is not an easy thing to do. But I also want to mention that Lance Lynn is a guy who's 1 year recovered from a serious injury, and I want to know if 2017 could be chalked up as a recovery year. Now, he had a 3.43 ERA, but he had a 4.82 FIP. He has had 175 or more innings pitched in 5 of the last 6 years. And I'm going to question, was he really just unlucky in that his home run to fly ball rate skyrocketed to 14.2% last year? You know, his career high was 10.4 before that. You know, his K per 9 is down into the mid-7s, which is something we haven't seen from him before. But again, is this a recovery year? So now Lance Lynn ends up in Minnesota. You know, it's the American League, which isn't quite as good, but it's the right division of the American League since Detroit and the White Sox and Kansas City have all but thrown in the towel. So tell me what to take from this Lance Lynn sighting, because I'm kind of excited about it. What do you think?
I like Lance Lynn. I think the Twins is, you know, a pretty good landing spot for him. I mean, it's not the worst place to pitch. It's not the best place to pitch. It's probably the best division in baseball to pitch in, as you're going to face some atrocious lineups as you alluded to. And I think when you look at Lance Lynn, he's just steady. Like, I know the FIP was bad last year, but otherwise the rest of his number, like a 3.43 ERA, sounds like money in the bank when you look at, you know, how many guys you're going to actually willingly draft that are expected to have ERAs over 4. And does the K-9 come back? The outside numbers look like it definitely could. His velocity, like, he lost half a tick on his fastball last year, but everything else looks pretty much right in line with his career. So I don't think it's the worst thing in the world for him to be there. And if you're someone who's listened to Matt Thompson rant about the Cardinals for years, the biggest complaint he always has is, you know, Matheny leaves his starters out there for too long. So if Paul Molitor doesn't make that mistake and pulls his starters out when he needs to, you might see things get better for Lance Lynn. So, I mean, I'm in. Like, I've always liked Lance Lynn. He's always been a steady, unspectacular guy. And I think those are the guys that you can build into your third, fourth, fifth rotation spots on your fantasy team and always return great value.
You know, and we didn't even really talk about motivation. Obviously, he was hoping to sign a much different deal than the deal that he ended up signing. We didn't even really talk about the motivation because, like, in my head, like, there's a difference. Like, I think Lance Lynn is just trying to recover some of his past excellence. Excellence isn't the right word, but some of his past performance that he had before, yet in injury recovery. And I think that would probably play as his biggest motivation. Because although if he has a good year, if he shows signs of getting back to where he was, it is going to be curious to see how the next offseason plays as far as people suddenly opening up the coffers. The big money teams got underneath the luxury threshold that we've heard so much about this offseason. And maybe there is a bit of good timing in if he can recover from that injury fully and get back to where he used to be and look like a steady innings eater, maybe that makes a huge amount of difference in how much money he can make in the next offseason.
Yeah, I'll be really interested. And one of the things that I think is going to happen before the next offseason is I think you're going to see a lot of players just take less money and sign extensions. Guys like Lance Lynn, I won't be surprised if you see sometime during the season, even if he has a good year, just take a 3-year, $40 or $50 million deal just to be locked up and have that security instead of having to deal with that extremely long free agency that didn't turn out the way they wanted it to.
Well, you know, the weirdest thing about the off season this year is that for years I've been wondering, like why is there always an owner that's willing to pony up, you know, extra millions upon millions of dollars to each one of these players? And so I deal with a bit of, you know, wow, the owners have really smartened up. And at the same time, you deal with a bit of, well, you know, they don't have that many employees for how much revenue they generate. So really, they should be willing to pay these guys more. So there's sort of a back and forth that goes on in my head here. And the biggest thing now is adding the age to it. You know, you take guys who get up over 30 years old, and the best players, we're just talking about Bryce Harper and Stanton and Trout. The best players are young players now, so paying old players doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. So there's going to be a lot at play going forward. And this next guy is another guy that, you know, it seems like an event show here, that a news event show that we're having, even though it really wasn't meant to be per se. Mike Moustakas, 29 years old. He had 160 RBI plus runs last year in his quote-unquote career year. Naturally, now you've got a Kansas City lineup that lost a little bit of depth, crazy enough. Jorge Bonifacio is not supposed to be depth, but they lost him for 80 games due to a PED suspension. So now the real question becomes, is this remotely good for Mike Moustakas? Because it's getting a lot of bad publicity right now, going to back to a spot where he struggled for a lot of the early part of his career compared to his prospect pedigree, and the fact that the lineup still has some really enormous holes in it. So what do you think about Mike Moustakas this year?
I don't mind Mike Moustakas this year. I mean, obviously Kansas City feels like the worst possible landing spot for him. But there's some comfort, I think, in going back to the same team. Him going back there makes their lineup considerably better. I mean, they lose Lorenzo Cain, they lose Eric Hosmer. But, I mean, if you can get something close to what you got from Whit Merrifield last year, that's not so bad. If you know, they still have Sal Perez. They've got it's not a great lineup, but I don't think it's by not even close to being the worst in that division. I think the biggest question around Mike Moustakas is who's the real Mike Moustakas? Is he the 38 home run guy, or is he the 22 home run guy? I mean, I think 70 runs and 80 RBIs seems perfectly acceptable. If you play in a league that counts strikeouts against you, then, you know, he's going to be a reasonably helpful in that way. And it's just a matter of, you know, Mike Moustakas has had so much fluctuation in what his seasons have looked like that it's really hard to predict. And I think that probably had a lot to go with why he went unsigned is, you know, you just look at it from 2014 forward. You know, 2014, he had 15 home runs, 45 runs, 54 RBIs, and hit 212. The next year, he hits 22 home runs, 73 runs, 82 RBIs, and hits 284. You know, and then last year, 38 home runs, 75 RBIs, 85 or 75 runs, 85 RBIs, and he hits 272. So which one of these three things is he? And you know, I think that's the obvious question moving forward. The projection systems don't hate him this year, even without a known landing spot. So it was probably just moved everything to neutral. You know, his worst projection looks like 27 home runs with 69 runs and 80 RBIs, and he hits about 268. I think if you're getting that still in the for anyone who drafted him while he was unsigned, I think you're getting him somewhere around the 14th round. I think that's going to be pretty good value for, you know, a guy that's going to play corner infield on your team.
Yeah, it's funny. One thing that you said that I find interesting is that I do believe that that's the worst lineup in that division. And I actually think it's the worst lineup by a great deal. So there's some, you know, it's not very easy to judge Yugos. And that's a really old analogy. Have you ever heard of a Yugo? Do you know what a Yugo is, Andrew?
I have not. No.
Okay. Well, it was a vehicle in the late 80s that came out that was made in Yugoslavia. And so it was called the Yugo, and it literally could not have come. Like, it was falling apart as you pulled it out of the lot when you bought it new. So we are comparing. We're comparing Yugos. There's no ands, ifs, or buts about it. But I actually prefer the Detroit lineup and the White Sox lineup a great deal more. I prefer them by a wide margin over the Kansas City lineup. But that being said, I do believe in all the points that you said, that it seems, you know, even on bad teams, bad teams still score runs. You know, you get down by a number of runs and you're facing the worst pitching that the other team has to provide because they're saving their good pitchers for games that are tight, that are coming forward. So there's enough to be said for Moustakas, and I love what you said about not knowing who he is, because 2 years ago the big story about Moustakas was that he was getting better against left-handed pitching and he was taking pitches the other way and he was doing this, and it was all this thought about growth. So I think Mike Moustakas has battled within his own profile. Like, is he a hyper aggressive pull hitter? Is he a guy who could shorten up things a bit in a lot of different situations and become a 295, 300 kind of hitter, despite the fact that, you know, he's not a good runner, so he's not going to bustle out a bunch of infield hits. So that's a really, I think that's a great perspective on Moustakas. I want to mention one more thing, since we're putting everything in a motivation. In a motivation, you know, scape here. Mike Moustakas turns down a qualifying offer for, is it 19 or 17 million?
I think it's 17.6 or something like that.
Okay, $17.6 million and signs for a max of $8 million. If you wanted to, like, put spitfire in someone, just think about if you personally had a chance to, you know, your current job offered you, you know, 2.5 times what you make, and you decide to turn them down, and you get, and a different company decides that your value is actually a third of that. So if there is a human motivation factor, Mike Moustakas is at the very top of the scale of having the most human motivation to stick it to all these different employers who decided that he was not worth more than what he's getting paid this year.
Well, or he's at least, at the very least, motivated to fire his agent who gave him the terrible advice to go out and test free agency instead of accepting $17.6 million.
I hate to give you this aside, but did you hear... Have you heard that Greg Holland, there's a report that Greg Holland turned down 3 years and $51 million. How? How did he do that? How do you get offered $17 million as a closer, you know, an aging closer? How do you get offered that and turn it down if that really happened?
Share the same agent, don't they? I think they're both Scott Boras guys.
It, like, just absolutely floors me that he could turn down $51 million as a relief pitcher.
I would love to have been a fly on the wall when Boras had to bring that contract to Moustakas. Like, what are you going to tell him at that moment in time? All right, Mike, here's the deal. You know, you're going to make maybe up to $8 million. But, you know, if you can club another 40 home runs this year, maybe we'll go up to 10 next year. What do you think, buddy? You want $20 million maybe on a two-year deal?
And, you know, he's another one that supposedly had turned down, you know, extension offers. So, I mean, it's a very odd landscape right now to look at some of these things. Now, we're going to switch to a completely different kind of motivation here, which you're probably sick of me on my soapbox the way it is. So this will work out good for you listeners out there. The next guy we're going to talk about is Wilson Ramos, the 30-year-old catcher whose career earnings took a huge swing when he suffered a knee injury at the end of his breakout season a couple seasons ago. So I have wildly been on Wilson Ramos as a buy this season, and I am very curious as to what Andrew thinks.
I've avoided Ramos, and in retrospect, I actually wonder why. Just because, I mean, Ramos is a really good player. When he's healthy, he is probably a top five catcher, for what that's worth. But when you think of the replacement value at catcher, especially in a one-catcher league, it's like, why not take a shot on a guy like Wilson Ramos? Like, I think his motivation is, you know, he wants to prove that he's the guy from 2016 that played 131 games, hit 22 home runs, drove in 80 runs, and, you know, given, if you look at a stat line from last year, there's no reason to think he couldn't do that again. I mean, I think the story in 2016 was that he'd had eye surgery, and now he was seeing the ball much crisper, so he can pick up the ball a lot better, and that made a big difference for him, and I think there's some reason to buy into that. And I actually think, in retrospect, I probably should be buying more into Wilson Ramos, because what's the, like, when you think about what you're going to pay for him, what's the worst thing that can happen? You drop him and get, you know, some other catcher who will probably provide you the same thing or better when he gets hurt. I don't think that's quite so bad.
You know, the Wilson Ramos is 30 years old now, and he doesn't look, he's kind of got the, I guess he's not quite as tall, but he's kind of got this Sal Perez kind of beefy look, sort of maybe closer to Yadi or Molina, this sort of beefy look. And so he doesn't look like he would be a really good hitter. But for a catcher, he's been a really good hitter. Now, nobody really expects him to go back to his 2016 production, and he did have a .327 BABIP. And the one thing that appearances don't lie about is that he doesn't look like a .327 BABIP guy. I mean,
catchers aren't .327 BABIP guys.
As a generality, let alone one that's beefy. And he's beefy. I'm beefy too. Maybe that's why I feel a tie-in to him. But I also think this, okay? Launch angle, all the launch angle experts love what Wilson Ramos has done with his launch angle in recent years. And they easily believe that he can hit 25 home runs. Right. The thing that's depressing his value is that he's on a Tampa Bay team that is running sort of a fire sale on most of its players, is how it's envisioned. I think the Souza trade is not really getting properly framed, because I think Anthony Banda, when you're a small market team, I think if Banda can be a 3 or 4 starter, you know, over the next 2 or 3 years, that's a lot of value to a small market team at, you know, at cost control. But the point being is that that lineup has lost Longoria. That lineup has lost Souza. You know, Kevin Kiermaier is one of its best remaining players, and he doesn't seem to be able to stay on the field, although I think he's an undervalued fantasy asset when he is on the field. But the point being is that you now have this framework where people say, well, we don't want anything to do with the Rays, and Wilson Ramos, his stats aren't going to jump off the page last year because he didn't start playing until midseason. And I think this has got buying opportunity written all over it. I would not be stunned in any way, shape, or form if the second best offensive catcher in all of baseball, this coming season is Wilson Ramos. That would not stun me. And we have not even mentioned that he had to sign this 2-year, very suppressed contract because he was coming off that knee injury. So whatever amount of money he can possibly make in his career going forward, he is on display this year. You know, and the fact that they've jettisoned the middle of the lineup means that Ramos can go into the middle of the lineup, which means, you know, whatever amount of offense they can generate, if there's any gas left in the tank for Carlos Gomez, you know, all these different players, anything that's left, you can put it on display. He can say, here's my portfolio. If I can do this with the Rays on a fire sale, can you imagine what I could do for the Colorado Rockies in the next offseason? You know, and I think there is a huge buying opportunity on Wilson Ramos. And he only needs to be about 75% of the player that he was in 2016 to really, really, really return incredible value for where he's getting drafted. You know, I see him fall, you know, I see him fall, especially in one catcher leagues, which are hard to gauge. I think ADP for catcher is the hardest thing to gauge because there's a huge difference between a one catcher league and a two catcher league. But I see him falling pretty deep into drafts. It's not unusual to see him be a guy who's falling into the 11th, 12th, 13th round, which to me has got value written all over it. How about a side story, which I'm good for side stories today, in case you haven't noticed, Andrew. Marco Estrada is the next guy we're going to cover, who is all of a sudden 34 years old. May 18th, 2010, my lovely wife and I were not yet married, and we decided to take a day trip to one day. We started driving at night. We went one day, and we saw a game in Cincinnati. And that day was May 18th of 2010. And that's when Marco Estrada made his Brewers debut. And we are sitting for an afternoon game, and it looked like it might rain, this, that, and everything else. The starting pitcher for the Brewers that day was Manny Parra, okay, who later did a lot of work for the Reds. But he was pitching against the Reds that day, against Homer Bailey. And what have you. But in the middle of that game, in the fifth inning, the Brewers brought in Marco Estrada, who me, as ardent a Brewer fan as I think you can find, I had no idea who he was. I had, like, never heard of him. He had, like, 12 total innings as a National, had sort of gotten picked up off of waivers. I had no idea who he was. And he throws three sparkling innings in a row, keeps him in the game, gives them a 4-2 lead, finally gives up a solo home run to Joey Votto, and then the Brewers bring in Trevor Hoffman. And our road trip gets ruined because he gets absolutely blown up. And that's the game where Trevor Hoffman lost his closing gig in Milwaukee for like the next, you know, 2.5 months until they brought him back to set the saves record. But regardless of all that, now Marco Estrada is 34 years old, coming up on he's in a contract year. He's never won more than 13 games. Some really unusual stats last year for Marco Estrada. His control was not what it had been. He had a 72% strand rate and a 30.3% ground ball rate, which all those are his worst lines since 2010. So the real question is the Bugs Bunny-esque changeup, etc., of Marco Estrada. Does he have a bounce back year in him, and do you think he's a value where he's getting drafted this year?
I think he's a value where he's getting drafted. I mean, I just pulled up the Great Fantasy Baseball Invitational ADP that Smato was kind enough to put together for everybody. His ADP is 275.5. Min pick at 196, which I think is extremely high. Low pick at 320, but I think if you're getting him around 300, I think it's worth buying in on that kind of bounce back. Estrada had some publicly bad issues last year. Apparently some infidelity problems. And that may have weighed in on him. I mean, his K per nine was, you know, actually among the best of his career. Best since he played in Milwaukee at 8.5, which is respectable. Walks were up, but not extremely up over his 2016 year. And his home run per nine came up, which was not unforeseen for Marco Estrada, who's always had He's always been over a one home run per nine. So he had some bad BABIP luck with, you know, a 295 BABIP, which seems extreme. That was up 60 points from the year prior. I mean, what I remember from the Estrada signing, as I live more or less inside the Toronto media market, is he was extremely excited just to sign for a few years. Like, he wanted the security of having a home and not having to deal with free agency. I think his motivation is going to be, hey, I'm still a major leaguer, and if you want to sign me for two or three more years, I'm happy to do so. Wherever that might be, I just want a home because I love playing in Major League Baseball.
Yeah, Marco Estrada is a very likable player because before he was in Toronto, he was in Milwaukee. And despite the fact that he had some troubles in Milwaukee leading up to him being jettisoned to Toronto, Marco Estrada is a very, very likable player. You know, he's out there, he sort of wears his heart on his sleeve while he's pitching. But, you know, he manages to get by with a ton of guile, and no one pitches backwards. And when he is on, nobody pitches backwards any more efficiently than Marco Estrada does. Like, the batter has no clue at a 3-2 count. If that batter gets a fastball, they're almost stunned because they're expecting the Bugs Bunny changeup. So there's so much to be said for what Marco Estrada has done, and maybe I'm just sentimentally rooting for him going forward, because he did a lot for the Brewers organization, and he's done a lot for the Toronto organization. I mean, years where it looked like they didn't have any pitching, they were getting a ton out of Jay Happ and Marco Estrada. And I do think Toronto will bounce back some this year. I think you will see a bounce back from Marco Estrada as well. I really do. The one thing about changeup guys that have worked with Guile, is they don't have to make the transition to being a pitcher because they're already a pitcher. You know, like, at some point, Noah Syndergaard is not going to be able to throw 100 anymore. So at that point, he's going to have to figure out a different way to get hitters out. The transition into being an older pitcher is something that Estrada has dealt with arguably his entire career, and is probably why Washington didn't really trust him as an asset going forward early in his career, because he's not a guy who jumps off the page at you. But I think he can be an awfully undervalued asset, and I do think that as an endgame play, I don't think he should go undrafted in leagues. Even smaller leagues, I don't think he should completely go undrafted. I really don't. So it'll be curious to see if he proves me right and can avoid father time being 34 years old as well. Well, we can end this like we're having a Toronto show here, because the last guy that really came to mind as a motivation guy this year is Josh Donaldson. I am the high guy in drafting Josh Donaldson in TGFBI. I think I'm the high guy on every single player I've taken, and maybe that's why the projection systems hate my team so much. But regardless of all that, I took him at 22 overall, which I can see, because there's no way that he was getting back to me, and I had gotten stuck at third base in a couple drafts before this one. His 289 BABIP last year was well below his career average. The lowest projection for Josh Donaldson next year is a 296 BABIP, 296 batting average with 32 home runs. And the real question that there's going to be for Josh Donaldson is, now that there's a slant against older players, is there one big contract next offseason out there for an older player? How do you frame Josh Donaldson, someone that hits close to home for you, my friend?
So I think I might actually also be the max guy on Josh Donaldson in the TGFBI drafts, because I might have got him at 36, because I know I got him in like the third round. I'm just trying to actually do the math. Might not have been, as 36 puts you at the end of that round. I was somewhere in the 30s, which felt like an incredible value to get. You know, he's only, like, when you look at what he did in the second half of last year, I mean, Donaldson's a stud. And if you haven't had much of a chance to watch Josh Donaldson, which I feel like a lot of people probably haven't, given that he's only ever played in Oakland and Toronto, and that most media markets are just not, like, people aren't just like, oh yeah, what do you want to do? What's on what's on tonight. And you live in another market, and you're like, let's see what the Blue Jays are up to, or let's see what the A's are up to. I don't think those are typical conversations. But he plays hard. Like, he's one of those guys that plays, like, gives everything on the field. Do I think there's a big contract left for Josh Donaldson? I really don't. I think he's been really good for a long period of time, but I don't see it out there. I think he's going to probably sign something like a 4-year, $100 million. I think he's going to be a $25 million guy. And I mean, I guess it's not that that's not a big contract, but I think when we think about big contracts today, we're talking, what, 150 plus? And I don't see that in the cards right now, especially with what's happened this offseason. So he's into his 30s now. He had some injury problems last year in, I think, they're ailing hamstring issues and some foot issues. So I love Josh Donaldson. He's been a member of many of my fantasy teams the last few years. And I think he's going to continue to be very good moving forward, but I don't think there's a big contract out there for him.
Well, when I was talking about a big contract, given his age, I think 4 years, $100 million, considering what aging players are doing right now, I think, you know, outside of Nelson Cruz, who's been much ballyhooed on this podcast, but, you know, when you look at, you know, the aging curve, I just want to frame Josh Donaldson as perhaps being one of the most inverted, one of the most odd career lines that I can ever recall. Just because, you know, he really didn't break into prominence in the majors until his late 20s, at a time when a bunch of players were breaking into major league prominence in their early 20s. Then most players go from trying to be a position player to trying to be a catcher. And he went from being a catcher to being a third baseman. You know, if I get any of this wrong, make sure you probably know more about Josh Donaldson than I do, even though I think I've tried to follow as closely as I can from afar. I just don't recall a player having this kind of a career path before. And now you got a guy, you know, we're talking about how productive he is and what a stud he is. And we started the show talking about a 25-year-old Bryce Harper that we have major injury concerns about. And now we're ending the show talking about a 32-year-old Josh Donaldson, and, you know, who's coming off a season that was injury marred. And we seem to be sort of less concerned about injuries. And the other irony is that he probably plays as hard as Bryce Harper does. He might play harder. If you can say anybody in the bigs plays harder than Bryce Harper, it might be Josh Donaldson. I mean, he looks like he is busting his tail and getting everything out of his ability at all times. You know, when you switch from catcher to third base, you assume that maybe he's going to be a defensive liability. And I get the opinion, and I don't know this, you're going to have to confirm this for me, that Josh Donaldson is an excellent defensive third baseman. Is he a good defensive third baseman?
He absolutely is, yeah. Like, he's definitely well above average in the eye test, at the very least. I haven't looked at his ultimate zone rating or anything like that. But when you watch him play, like, he's got range. He's making all the plays that you would expect from a third baseman and then some. Like, he's not Manny Machado, but he's not that far off.
Yeah, and I mean, so he's really an interesting case study in players. Aging curves don't generally go like this. Let's put it this way. Like, he seemed like his performance has really, really arced up as he got into his late 20s and into his early 30s. So there will be speculation that it could fall off at any time. I do see some injury risk, a little more than most, with Josh Donaldson. But, you know, since I was the high guy on him in this set of drafts, it makes me think that, you know, I'm also sort of, I want to will him to success because of how he's played out his career and how he's done. We also had a long discussion about Franklin Barreto, who is the main prospect that the Blue Jays traded to the Oakland Athletics. We also had a long discussion in the chat room about him earlier this week, since Barreto is no longer projected to be a shortstop that can beat out Marcus Semien. which is just so bizarre to me. Judging prospects is, you know, I feel for Matt Thompson because it's like trying to judge the weather. I think it's awfully hard to be right most of the time, and that's what your goal is. But regardless of all that, I think you're going to see Josh Donaldson do everything he can to have a huge year here. And he's unlike so many of these other players that he doesn't have this backlog of huge career earnings that he's sort of going off. You know, I looked it up the other day. Jake Arrieta had $32 million, has made $32 million already. And Josh Donaldson is going to have the same issue that Arrieta sort of had, and that he's going to have a smaller window to make a lot of money in. He's not somebody who, like Mike Trout, signed a contract, a huge, an enormous contract, but he said, you know what, I'm going to opt out when I'm getting close to 30 because I could sign another huge deal. Well, that's not the way the cards unfolded for Josh Donaldson. But when Josh Donaldson is right and playing well, Josh Donaldson is great for Major League Baseball. And, you know, and I thought this was my last chance to own a piece of Josh Donaldson this year in TGFBI, but I am not, I'm not really sorry that I made the pick at 22 because I could not expect Josh Donaldson to get back to me in the third round. But Donaldson, I think some of the things people don't realize about him is his hustle factor also means that he's not a zero in stolen bases at third base. He's a, you know, a 7-10 stolen base guy. And if reports about the leaner Kendrys Morales, you know, and his bounce back is there, I think Kevin Pillar is underrated. I think there is a lot more to this.
Sorry, I'll stop you on that one. I don't think Kevin Pillar is anywhere close to underrated. If you've watched Kevin Pillar play, I think, if anything, he might be slightly overrated, even in the fantasy landscape. He's just a terrible contact. He doesn't hit for much contact, and he probably gets more, like, he'll get you some steals, but I don't think you should expect, like, the world from Kevin Pillar.
Well, you're closer to that team than I am. Last year in the second half, he had a run where they were really short on players, and I thought they were leaning on Kevin Pillar more for offense, and he was kind of coming through. So maybe I see some of a breakthrough for Kevin Pillar that you clearly don't see. Which is okay. I'm just saying that as peripheral players, you know, if Justin Smoke is for real, and what have you, I think there is a chance for Josh Donaldson to have a really, really big year this year. I really believe that. Do you believe in that?
I do. I think he could have a year close to his MVP year from a couple years ago. I don't think 40 homers is out of the question, not in the AL East. Which still isn't exactly chocked full of stud pitching, with just great ballparks to hit in almost everywhere you go. I think their lineup is improved. It's going, like, they're going to be a lot deeper. They're not playing Ezekiel Carrera in the outfield anymore, which is probably positive. They released him the other day. Adding guys like Solarte and players of that ilk who aren't superstars, but they're solid everyday guys. You had Curtis Granderson and Randall Grichuk, who, you know, as I've talked about before, I think is going to be provided extreme value in the outfield this year as a guy with 30 home run, 10 steal potential. I mean, I think it's there. I don't think the Blue Jays are going to be terrible this year. I think they'll be the third best team in the AL East, but, and for Donaldson, I think that could easily mean that he's a 35 home run guy with 100 runs, 100 RBIs. It looks like they're planning to hit him back out of the two hole again this year, which means you're going to need some depth, or you're going to need guys at the back of their lineup to get on base, but for him to reach 100 RBIs at least. But there's going to be, I think he's going to be real close to 100 runs, if not over it, and hit you more than enough home runs.
Is there any hope for a Russell Martin bounce back?
There is. I mean, I think the biggest issue with the Blue Jays is that they've got a lot of players over 30. And I think that's going to potentially lead to Morales playing less, because they're going to need to rotate some guys in and out of that DH spot to keep them healthy. And Donaldson's one of those guys. And that was part of the reason why Morales had less playing time last year, was because when Donaldson came back from injury and they didn't want him out playing the field, they DH'd him. So I think he'll see 10, 15 games, maybe 20, depending on how he's feeling. But it'll be interesting because I'm unsure. Like the management group in Toronto has been purposely vague the entire offseason. They've not been willing to show any of their cards. And I wouldn't be surprised if they were willing to purposely suppress their own value, or maybe not necessarily do everything that they could to win, because I think that they really, you know, based on what they had done in Cleveland, where they built from the ground up, I feel like that's what they want to do. But the media market, which is fueled by the team itself, as the team owns the media, oddly enough, and you know, the generalized fan interest right now, as they've been, you know, filling 40,000 a night in the stadium, is leading them to at least appear to try to be a contender, whether they truly are or not.
Yeah, well, I do agree that it's a roster that could go either way in a number of different facets. You know, we already have some Marcus Stroman sort of nagging injuries, and the pitching has overperformed mostly for the last 4 or 5 years. But generally speaking, that's a hard thing to pull off for long term, is to get by on guile like Jay Happ does, like Marco Estrada does, you know, even to an extent what Marcus Stroman does, stream ground.
To what Jaime Garcia is going to have to do to, like, they're like, the pitching staff is the epitome of just a group of solid but unspectacular guys, with the exception of Aaron Sanchez, who, if he can figure out how to strike people out, could be, and not have blisters and lose his fingernail, could be, you know, has the potential to be a top, you know, 10 pitcher in baseball.
Aaron Sanchez is an incredible value right now in drafts, in my opinion, especially ones where, you know, he floats past where his ADP is. And I will own shares of Aaron Sanchez this year. There's no doubts about that. They're a really fascinating team to try and figure out what's going to happen with the Blue Jays, because they could go a number of different ways, you know, and each individual player feels like it outside of Donaldson. If Donaldson's healthy, he's going to be very good. Do we really know what Justin Smoke exactly is? You know, he had so many platoon struggles going into last year. All of a sudden the breakout comes up and you get this monster 35-plus home run season. You know, there's just, you know, Russell Martin has been everywhere and nowhere. Really, his entire career, he's been everywhere and nowhere. I mean, he's always been a good defensive catcher, but I remember him as a Dodger catcher that everybody drafted for stolen bases, you know, and then, you know, the off and on years that have followed through his travails as a major leaguer offensively are crazy. So I do think it's going to be, there's Devon Travis is another complete mystery guy. You know, just, you can hear fantasy pundits say, just get the guy on the field healthy for 135 or 140 games and you've got a top 10 second baseman, which I think is an exaggeration, by the way, but is still, you know, you can still hear people say things like that. So all the different pieces, parts are really hard to judge in Toronto. But being in the AL East, being in a ballpark that has generally been pretty good offensively, I know the numbers are not as good offensively in recent years, you know, just makes a fascinating case study as to what's going to happen north of the border. And it should keep Andrew entertained when he has to watch his local broadcast for the Blue Jays. Oh. I cannot stand their announcers, by the way, for what it's worth.
Neither can I. I'm also not a Blue Jays fan, so I don't actually watch that many Blue Jays games. So.
Well, good for you, my friend.
Yeah,
well,
I bought the V.TV package for a reason.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I think we went through a really interesting group of players that I haven't heard a lot about on other broadcasts, except for Bryce Harper. You can sort of always hear a lot about Bryce Harper, you know, from clown questions to everything else. Bryce Harper seems to always be sort of in the media spotlight. But regardless, I thank you so much for your time and your excellent effort and all your preparation as usual, Andrew. Why don't you tell people your Twitter handle and where you can be reached?
Sure. Find me at Andrew K. Dewhurst. I dropped an article a bit, my second baseball article of the year last week, talking about why I shouldn't like all of my great fantasy baseball invitational hitters. I'm going to try to do a similar piece for my pitchers as well. And still pumping out some hockey content for the next few weeks until probably about opening day, because that's right about when the hockey season ends. So that times out pretty well.
And I am Chuck Anderson, and I can be reached at Just Chucking It, which is a blog that I did for a number of years. That my writing has suffered a bit so far as me trying to get enough time to do the multiple podcasts and come up with concepts and do extra snippets of writing. But I'm still I'm pushing myself to get to that goal so I get some stuff out for everyone on FWFB. I really enjoy my role as the old guy at FWFB, and it's an incredible group to be around. Please consider the fantasy baseball preview draft guide that we put out. If you've got drafts that go till late this month, you can download just a PDF of it. If you contact Justin Mason, you can also get it sort of in ebook form. And if you're like me and you want to have a copy of your word in print, you can order the paperback copy off of Amazon as well. So it is called The Fantasy Benefit. And I think we're doing a lot of great work for you guys out there, and hopefully we keep you as entertained as possible. I am a podcast guy myself. I listen to 4 or 5 podcasts a week minimum. And so I know I always appreciate contact. I always appreciate content being regularly put out there. So hopefully you keep up with us and you stick with us through the baseball season, because I think this concept podcast has gone really well. I've gotten really great feedback from it. So we will keep it going for you. And Andrew has been excellent to work with, and I'm looking forward to the season a great deal. So, signing off for another concept podcast, trying to judge the incentives, it's the incentive-laden podcast, for God's sakes. So, I hope you enjoyed, and, give us an excellent review on iTunes. I think we deserve one, and I might be biased. So, anyway, we'll continue to cover everything, and we'll continue to laugh at my team in TGFBI, and see if maybe the systems are wrong, and maybe my team's not as bad as everyone thinks it is, and we will go from there. Thanks a lot for the listen. We appreciate it.